Hello. So I'm just going to introduce the poets, and then I'll let them read, and then we're going to have a little discussion at the end, and hopefully include everyone here, or as many people as we can fit in. So I'm going to introduce everyone together, and then they're going to read in the order in which I'm introducing them for around 10 to 15 minutes each. So firstly, we're going to hear from Carmen Buggen, whose books include the memoir, Burying the Typewriter, Childhood Under the Eye of the Secret Police, which was a finalist for the George Orwell Prize for Political Writing, among other awards. And her collections of poems include Releasing the Porcelain Birds, The House of Straw, and Crossing the Carpathians. The first two published by Shearsman and the last by Carcanet. She's also written a critical study of Seamus Heaney and Eastern European poetry and translation called Poetics in Exile. And after that, we're going to hear from Sean Hewitt, who is a winner of an Eric Gregory Award, a Northern Writers Award, and the Resurgence Prize. His pamphlet, Lantern, was the Poetry Book Society choice, and I think was just shortlisted for the Michael Marks Award. So congratulations, Sean. And his debut, Tongues of Fire, is forthcoming from Cape in May 2020. And then finally, we're going to hear from Richard Osmond, whose first collection, Useful Verses, came out 2017, was it? And won the Seamus Heaney First Collection Award, won an Eric Gregory Award, and was shortlisted for the Costa Prize. His latest book, which just came out this year, is called Rock, Paper, Scissors, and is a collaged response to the poet's direct experience of the terrorist attack on London Bridge on June the 3rd, 2017. So, I'm going to hear from Carmen, Sean, and Richard, and then have a discussion. So, hope you enjoy.
Hello, once again, it's a pleasure to be here. And I am delighted to be able to actually continue the painful conversation from last night's reading. Hopefully it wasn't too painful. But in this reading today, I want to talk about transforming the secret police records on my family. This is about 4,500 pages that I received access to about 25 years after we left Romania. And at that point, when I got the records, I thought I was more or less writing about memory and nostalgia and exile and family and children. And then suddenly the poetry has taken a very dark turn because I was receiving letters I haven't received for 30 years, and they were coming from my father in prison. And I also had access to transcripts of a visit to prison, which I made to my father at the age of 17, in the harshest prison in Romania for political dissidents in Aiud, and I had actually wiped all that memory out, and then the conversation was transcribed, and I found it. So I want to read to you the poems that have come out of that interaction with the secret police records, because now I am in a third stage of being a political refugee poet, and that is realizing that my private life is a public record of Cold War surveillance. Releasing the Porcelain Birds. I found her porcelain birds today, three in one room, eight in the other. And those brought back to my mind the one with the broken wing, my sister, and I once fixed with mother's nail polish and a matchstick. The one bird with the broken neck, Loredana, and I hid in a dog's cage outside, not to make her angry. This is only a house inventory by meticulous investigators. Porcelain figurines, they say. An elephant, a lion, a little girl with two puppies. And the birds, still around the ballerina, among the crystal glasses and champagne flutes, the bottle of Slivovitz, my parents' glamorous marriage, their prized vacuum cleaner and Bulgarian rose perfume, my father's 7 shirts, 2 colorful ties, their tape recorder MK-235 automatic Grundig made by Unitra Poland, a black table with intertwined vine design, and again, 3 porcelain figurines, birds, a wall library with drawers and display case, 2 hats made of light fabric and 1 leather hat, 3 man suits, a thick short coat, 4 woman summer dresses, a violin, and a guitar. My mother loved porcelain birds. They must have made her think of flying when such thoughts were banished by men with keys to our house who chained her husband to the walls of prisons because his mind escaped to freedom. He represents a danger to our state, a file says. Use all methods to monitor her, including special methods. A radio Selena, a radio Gloria, display case with books for reading. How far you traveled, my still swans, my white sparrows, archived for 30 years all over the country, shelved and cleared. I see you now. When I am too old to take you in my hands and run with you around the rooms of the house, or place you on tree branches to see what the singing birds make of you, to mend you when you shatter, as I did long ago. A birthday letter. This is actually one postcard we have received from my father. The words the source informs you echo in my head that other voice, familiar, comfortable almost, lining our private cries. The inmate wrote to his wife and children from the Aiud prison. Our letters journeyed through the clay-like maze of secret police desks. Stamps, checks, dates, signatures indicate officers and places. The paraphrase of ongoing pain, half the time they paraphrase us. That voice and introduction sticks to our words like a skin disease, impossible to cure. But then, some sentences from us burst free, perhaps, because they're not translatable, editable, condensable. They stand out in quotation marks, unexpected, missing heartbeats. On May 4, 1985, my father thought about his birthday. Make a cake with 50 candles and take a picture. I recall the cake on our kitchen table and thinking about him in chains that day. My dear, the children are healthy, mother said. Come to see me with my children, he said. Do you remember me coming home with snow on my brow? Children, I so much miss you. I kiss you all and your mother and me. How beautiful it would have been for you to have been here too. Sell everything you can, he urged. Send the children to school. Do not despair. I might be coming home soon. We hung onto those few words that could cross the clay-like, murky territories between us. These letters were like skin that covered and protected our bodies from the cold outside. Each word a capillary that carried and supported the life in each one of us. Each word was limitless, clothed our souls and warmed against despair, shielded us from their world of terror, transported chills, shivers, anger, warmth from us to Father and back from Him to us. They took us to each other as we were. When the censor took our words and talked about them, discarded our handwriting and wrote his, he became a flaying instrument. Letters we sent were not received until now, 30 years on. We, the satyr tied to our tree. The censor scraped at capillaries of our words. What survived is howling. A year has passed with no news from you. Something awful is happening to you. No one looks after us anymore. They're all busy. Mother is ill and short-tempered. Even grandmother has left. It's disgraceful that you have nothing to eat. 30 years have gone, and we have lived with exposed wounds, doubts, fears, uncertainties. Now I find the family letters from back then in a mist of thousands of records. I reconstruct the way we used to speak, the way skin used to feel when it was still alive, denatured letters in the handwriting of the censor. I make out capillaries under the flaying instrument. I reconstruct parts of the skin from the words that were copied out. We now know what has been taken from us and how. Words alone saved us then and bring joy now, the joy of finding them. For in their frail syllables, I recognize the old self. Apollo has cleaned his instrument and left. And I'll read one more. Butnaru at the visit with his daughter. This is the name of the transcript. The slash of sliding glass on glass at the window as the guard prepared the microphone between us. When my breath went from my room to his, another visit comes to mind, but not this. When I said that life is hard, no wood for winter, no one to help, school year finished well, and I aim to go to university. This is a memory I no longer have. Aged 17, gone to prison to see my father all on my own. Mother was ill. The transcript says the Abj, my father, rejoiced in my visit, the audience with his daughter. He asked for news from home, then told me his. Father said, they say, was ill with nerves, but calming down lately. Asked for medicines, and then announced that in the autumn he might come home. He charged me with looking after mother, my little brother, and working my hardest at school. Things will become easier when he returns. Even today, I do not dare ask him how it felt then to look through the glass wall and see a kind of freedom on the face of his child. 2 days on trains from our village to Ayud, I wish I could remember what I thought, if I was afraid to make the trip alone, and how I felt about leaving him in that glass room with his feet and hands in chains, my head full of news to bring home to my ailing mother. A quarter century without memory of this visit? Now the handwriting of the officer on duty calls me to the scrap transcript with my name on it. Daughter of a convict with a code name. My grandfather's name, to be exact. Probably used as a mnemonic device that linked us through generations across the country. The record remembers what I no longer keep in a self that I made with forgetting. Now the struggle is between me and a piece of paper that talks about the girl. The visit closes once again, dear life. I pray, let it be as tender this time too. No crying, no hysterical emotions, just pushing on and getting through. And yet, here's my father, framed in his jailer's words, our private sorrows like those of characters in plays, at once my life and so removed from me. My father, his jailer, and I, a fine triangle. Time on my side, I fling the stone of rescued memory into the river where you cannot step twice. Thank you.
Hello. Thanks everyone for coming. It's a really nice panel to be on and to be reading with these two poets. I'm going to start off with a Suffolk poem because I thought, where else should I start with a Suffolk poem but here? This poem is called Barn Owls in Suffolk. I watch them for a long while, the pair rising and courting the field in daylight, the strange geometry of their faces funneling the air, and everything, their whiteness, their sense of having slipped through from another world, their focus on the hunt. In the end, it all comes down to their silence, the way each feather disperses the air, how each wavers. And I wonder what omen it is to see two barn owls hunting in mid-morning, so quietly secretive. For surely there is something in the slow spread of the wing, the moment of inverted flight, the living thing pulled from the earth and lifted. As Will was saying, I've got a book coming out next year, so I'm going to read a couple of poems from Lantern, but mostly from the new book. It ends with a series of, I don't really know what to call them, they're not quite elegies, but they're kind of leaning in that direction. This one features a statue or a marble portrait that's in the Bode Museum in Berlin. It's of an Italian cardinal, but it was damaged by fire in the Second World War, so it has part of it is fallen off, is kind of half broken. So that's what this poem refers to. It's called In the Bode Museum. On a narrow plinth in the corner of the gallery, a stone portrait. A man, his mouth unlipped by fire, marble of the face peeled off in the blaze. But the clothes were spared somehow, as though above the neck he was hung on a noose of flame. And still one unburnt eye, looking up over the broken shoulder to where his sculptor stood, hush. No one is coming. We are handed our lives by a fierce work. Onto which blank space will I lock my gaze when my father is gone? How am I to wear his love's burning mantle? This next poem takes as its title, it's called Tar Prom. Tar Prom is one of the temples in the Angkor complex in Cambodia. You may have seen pictures of it. It's the one that they've kind of left in a half state of disrepair. It has trees that grow through the temple, and they kind of are also holding the temple up. So if those trees die, the temple will collapse around them. This is called Tar Prom. A stifling heat, the air heavy, and all around the loud, wet forest knotting the gaps in its own sound. A peace long earned, then broken, and you far off in the hospice bed. Silk cotton, strangler fig, fastened here on the temple as though it grew down from heaven, was sent to hold in place all this human work. And later, through the house of fire, the fallen galleries, I climbed in blue smoke to where the god sat, ringed with incense. And yes, I knelt to her. And yes, I prayed through unbelief. Perhaps now, Father, only something old and impossible can save us. I haven't read this poem before, but it's the title poem of the new collection, so I thought I would. It's relatively long. It's called Tongues of Fire, and on the cover of the collection will be a picture. That title refers to a fungus called Tongues of Fire that grows on a juniper, and it kind of comes out like orange tongs out of the branches. And the second stage of its life is that the spores go into hawthorns, and the hawthorns grow. The berries are white and they're ruined by the fungus. So it has two stages in its life cycle. So this poem is called Tongues of Fire. One other thing, the fungus, its Latin name for the species is Claviriform. So I do say that at one point in the poem, and that's what that refers to. So Tongues of Fire. And up here, something uncanny appearing through the drizzle. A dozen or more junipers, all ranked with bright tongues. Yellow fruiting thorns pricked in hundreds over the bark like a sheath of fire. Rot the colour of the sun's late wheel slowing over the brittle heath where, in the grey damp of April, some mute violence is budding on all these shaking forms. A fungus blooming in orange horns. And I would say that I have come upon the cones of God, the Pentecostal flame fallen to the bush at night and burning here like a prophecy that everything will be lit before it is consumed. But now I have learnt, as we all do in time, that no flesh is incorruptible, which is why I am here on the uplands with the gold crest and the firecrest nesting. claviriform. These tongs are rooted in the branch and must ruin it to speak. And so I wonder, must God be known through entropy? The matter of the world dissolved, taken back into the empty, inconceivable, ensouled nothing that waits behind and presses against its forms. God, like an intimacy that pressures and bends. And this today is where he has chosen to speak, or where I have chosen to hear him speaking, where I have conjured meaning when I have needed to see a fungus on the juniper as a bright ancestral messenger bursting through from one realm to another, a sign of what? An oracle or a breaking of Christ in a reel of telial horns to give an account of the world as it has changed for us? Closer, it is almost as though I can hear the bush ticking, the cells of the wood dividing as the tongs push out and lick the air and soften their embers on the bark. I hold out my hands, wanting heat, some evidence of energy releasing, a voice to speak even in the friction of atoms on the air, but nothing now. Nothing but the thrum of the wind and the itch of the branches rubbing their thin wrists sore in the open. Over all this wide heath, the spores are lifting, being carried off and latching down in the hedgerows where the hoars will come white and ruined, the cancer's metastatic flight from host to host through the air as though I am living in it. All this to say that since the news, we have leant around my father and known love's fragility, its imminence in the body, the proximity it takes to material form, visible here on the heath, but at home unseen, working inwards. This morning, I knelt by his bed and held his thin hand, my thumb pressed around his, palms touching, and kissed it while he slept. Only the rattle of his chest lifting and sinking, hardly any words for weeks now, the tumour suppressing the vocal cords, and then a sudden need to see inside, to know for myself which cells on the lung were splitting each minute and breaking time into this kaleidoscope of slow haul and frantic loss. No apparition, no tongue of fire to tell us before too late of the blight on his frame. Only a few months and then this. And so we hold him now, while he is here. Listen to the organs tell what they can of life, our insufficiency, and we weigh it over with a spill of love, an undiked river, as if now or never the world must be flooded with its soul, knowing that as one body breaks, we must break our own to show ourselves, to split the God from us. And is this nature turned outwards? This disruption, is it a way of working, a way of nature inverting so that God can be known? Too cruel, surely. This is love working against the world. This is when we make God and speak in his voice, crying again amongst the shivering wild. Father, like God, we can only talk through things, a tongue of fire lashing and nothing incorruptible. Our life is a theophany. We will work to know through time what flesh can hold, the moment in which a magnitude can be carried inside a form without it breaking. In this world, I believe there is nothing lost, only translated. Our lives are shot through it, and I am here this evening as a supplicant, asking over and over for correlation, that when all is done and we are laid down in the earth, we might listen and hear love spoken back to us. Thank you very much for listening. I'm just going to read one last poem. It's called Wild Garlic. Out in the copse after rain, too late after dark to be here. Warm soil, wood lice dripping from the underside of leaves. I root down to the tender stalks and twist them free. Soaked petals dip and touch my arm. Kernels of bud, itch of foliage, of wildness on my skin. The plants are carrying the smell, earth rich, too heavy to lift above head height, and my boots and jeans are bleached with it. I turn home, and all across the floor, the spiked white flowers light the way. The world is dark, but the wood is full of stars. Thank you.
Hello. So I hope the story kind of speaks for itself in parts here, but I was in a bar on London Bridge during the terrorist incident in 2017, and in processing a lot of the kind of confusion and aftermath of that, I found myself writing this book, which is not just my story. It's a kind of collage incorporating translations from Beowulf and also translations from the Quran. Beowulf because I found the Grendel attack was strikingly similar to my experience of being in a kind of ritualistic beer-drinking hall and then having a monster try to burst in and do violence. So I end up leaving a lot of the kind of violent imagery to the original text of Beowulf, but also the Quran because it's such a kind of overdetermined text and quite controversial to even think of translating it that it felt like it had some of the kind of heat and controversy of writing about my experience, and also that it kind of feels like it's part of a different category of a different language game, and I wanted that feeling of kind of trying to write outside of the ordinary game of poetry. But I'll read some sections. Sometimes I'm going to tell you which bit comes from which text, and sometimes I'm not going to, so just let it wash over you. This is Beowulf. The creation song. The brazen ghoul who dwelled in the dark had a hard time having to hear each and every day the loud sound of people having fun in the hall. There was the harp's clear ringing. There was sweet song sung by a singer who, since he knew how to sing so well of mankind's making long ago, did so. The singer said the Almighty made the earth, all aspects and elevations of those bright meadows about which water bows and bends and held the sun and moon aloft like gleaming trophies and covered all the corners of the earth with a decorative fretwork of bows, boughs, branches, limbs, and leaves. He shaped or sang every moving kind of thing alive to life. And so the Lord's men lived the dream until someone, a murdering fiend, a Wendigo, a demon from the depths of hell, began to commit atrocities. His name was Grendel. This is from the Quran. The bee. A sign will be apparent here to those who reason. God inspires the bee directly. Bee, build in the mountains. Build in trees and houses. Build in buildings. Feed on all fruits and follow in the paths and hollow ways trodden for you by the Lord. And from the bee's belly flows a drink of many colors to feed and heal mankind. Surely on reflection, this must be a sign. Sand. I'm on the beach in Galveston with Beth's son Luke, who is 4. We build a castle, then we build a turtle, and a tuna fish chasing the turtle, and a whale about to swallow the tuna fish and turtle, and then Luke builds a car crashing into the whale. Stories told in sand are clearly not beholden to the classical unities, nor obliged to be consistently either comic or serious in tone. Anything can collide with anything at anything else at any time, as in life. Herring gulls want to eat our Cheez-Its. A van plows into pedestrians on London Bridge. I use a piece of string to give the turtle a silly smile. Luke laughs at this. Someone pulls a grey blanket over a man in Borough Market. I come with a sign from God. I make for you from clay the shape of a bird and breathe into it, and it becomes a bird. Rock, paper, scissors. 8 hours into Rob's stag, which had started strong with a pub crawl up the Bermondsey beer mile and was now beginning to sag at a Wetherspoons near Tower Bridge, a match of rock, paper, scissors was breaking out to pick between the following two options for what would happen next. 1, we go to Katzenjammer's authentic German beer keller under London Bridge, where we would listen to an Umpar band, eat sauerkraut, drink liter steins of Paulaner Dunkel, and be held in the basement by police for our own protection as terrorists attack the door outside. See bloody victims hurry down the stairs to shelter in the bar, watch paramedics treat slash wounds to the throat and stab wounds to the stomach and slash and stab wounds to the throat and stomach, and hear a woman sob and hyperventilate because of what she couldn't bring herself to tell us she had seen up on street level, and take cover under the traditional wooden benches when armed officers burst in with automatic weapons yelling, "Down, get down, get down!" Or 2, we go to a strip club. The game began, Emmett and Matt competing. So it's 1, 2, 3, go, and play on go. 1, 2, 3, go. Both guys threw down scissors first. 1, 2, 3, go. Both changed tack dramatically and went for paper. All bets were off. 1, 2, 3, go. They cast their final shapes. Emmett for the beer bar stuck fatefully with paper, while Matt, solidly in favor of the strip club, chose rock and lost. The decision had been made, and I dwell on it for bathos mainly, and because the world is made of games of rock, paper, scissors like this one. Not only in the sense that every flip or arbitrary choice has disproportionately huge and permanent results, but in the sense that every gesture, either of victory or defeat, aggression or surrender, depends for its meaning on another. Put it this way, a photograph of Matt's third and losing move, viewed in isolation, appears to show a man raising his fist in anger about to throw a punch. Only those who know which game of signs he's playing at will read the hand as rock, and even rock means nothing without further context. In rock, paper, scissors, rock is capable of meaning strength, or weakness, or indifference, depending on the sign selected to contest it. We called an Uber to take us to London Bridge. The evil one advanced angrily over the beer hall's flagstone floor, his eyes fixed, and in them a sick flame flickered on a band of men sleeping there together. And his heart leapt at the thought of tearing each man life from limb, and his heart leapt at the thought of severing each man's soul from his body one by one. He foresaw for himself a feast of human meat that night, and he was right, but fate had it that the feast would be his last. The beast didn't delay. He took the first opportunity to seize, slash, and slay a sleeping man. He bit into the sinews which bound his bones together. He drank the blood and gulped down great gobs of flesh. Soon he had swallowed the whole dead man, even his feet and hands. A tall, thin man. I didn't see him in that imagistic way a poet in a poem sees things like a wheelbarrow or a discarded woman's shoe and captures them and their whole essence out of time. I saw him, lost him in the crowd, found him, looked away, and then looked back again to check that what I saw was what I thought it was. It was a tall, thin man. A tall, thin man holding bundled cloth against his neck. A tall, thin man with wadded fabric held against his neck, soaked with blood-red blood, who had found his way downstairs to Katzenjammer's to shelter underground with an expression on his face I didn't recognize at first, because just as I did not perceive him in a singular or poetic way, neither did he perform his suffering according to convention, but looked frightened in a way few actors would act when asked to portray fear, blank, withdrawn, and with a gait and posture of both stiff dignity and urgent shame, like one of those people you read about who, when they start to choke in public, hurry to the bathroom in embarrassment and die alone. And as for poets, deviants follow them. Haven't you noticed them roaming the valleys, doing the opposite of what they say? The zakum tree, the tree of bitterness, sinner food. Its fruit will bubble in the belly like molten metal, seethe and simmer like scalding water. Seize him and take him to the heart of fire. Pour boiling liquid punishment over his head. You, the once powerful, the once refined and dignified, this is precisely what you didn't believe would happen. And all the while, the righteous will be safe in gardens next to freshwater springs, dressed in outfits of both light and heavy shuttle-woven silk, chameuse and brocade, sitting face to face with each other. They'll be married to beautiful people with beautiful eyes, like freshwater springs, and be free to call for any fruit they like. Poetry. In October 2018, I was interviewed about this book on ITV London News. As I answered questions on the nature of poetry as a response to traumatic experience, my voice was layered over silent images of that night, or rather, images of police, paramedics, and the luminous cordons they erect to keep the media at safe remove from the matter of their work. The interview, which appeared to take place in an industrial chic studio environment, all exposed wood, glass, and steel, a panorama of the city skyline to the rear, was actually shot in a windowless basement painted uniformly green, the color of the leaves of fragrant butterbur or winter heliotrope, a bright but natural hue which chroma key technology and the vision mixer made transparent and replaced with the images of the non-existent set. While citing some of the online resources my translations draw upon, I've discovered that one website, corpus.quran.com, is not only a tool to help readers parse the intricate grammar of the Quran, it's an exercise in computational and corpus linguistics, combining morphological and syntactic annotations with a complex branching diagram of the ontology of concepts within the text for the express purpose of one day creating, out of the verbatim and unaltered word of Allah as revealed to the Prophet Muhammad through the Archangel Gabriel, an artificial intelligence entirely fluent in Quranic Arabic, capable of directly conversing with students about the spiritual message of the book with no intervention from the programmer who created it. Erm und Axel. When war bold Beowulf placed the entirety of Grendel's grip, his whole torn off shoulder, his whole arm and hand together on display beneath the big hole in the hall roof, the the sign was unambiguous. Thank you.
Thank you, Carmen, Sean, Richard. So this event was framed as poetry of witness. And yeah, it's been really fascinating and moving to see all the different ways in which you've each witnessed or tried to bring across that witness. And one thing that struck me is that, so the idea of poetry as witness comes from Caroline Forshay, the American poet. And for her, she wrote this essay about it, a famous essay, where she talks about the need for poetry to occupy this space, which isn't purely political and social and isn't purely poetic, but which is kind of in between. And the poetry is the evidence of having been there. She calls it the trace. Mm-hmm. But I notice with all of your work, in a way, it's not about you physically, but you're using other sources to mediate between you and having been there. Like in your case, Carmen, the transcripts with the imagery of nature as a way of talking about your father and the fungus, and obviously Richard with Beowulf and the Quran, these translations. And I wonder how, this is a very long-winded way of saying, how does witness operate for you? What do you think about that command that Caroline Forshay issues for the poet to leave that trace, to say that they've been there? How do you feel that works in your own life and your work? Maybe we can swing around this way from Carmen.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I mean, Caroline Forshay went to El Salvador.
Yeah.
She had, I think, her first academic job, and she was approached to go there. And she looks at witness from the point of view of an American who goes to look at the suffering of other people. So that works a bit differently from the way I talk about the family history. For me, is the personal history of oppression is mixed in with the sort of the public voice of the poet, but it's also part of the history of the Cold War. So it makes it at once very easy to talk about the historical moment, because it's a personal experience. So in a sense, I feel that I own some of that suffering. But there is also the burden of, you know, there is this sort of, when you are making a testimony yourself as a poet, it's almost like you are being held to very, very high standards, in a sense that you really have to reflect the truth, the historical truth, at the same time as you're talking about how you experience that truth. And so it's been quite fascinating, for example, to work with records, because a lot of the records are also sort of not only paraphrases of what we have said, but a lot of them are lies that they made up in order to keep themselves employed to spy on my family. Mm. So, you know, it was very difficult for us to sort of untangle as a family. Try to remember this. Do you think you would have said this, or do you think you would have done that? Or do you think so-and-so in a family would have spied, or what was it used as a prop? So, for me, witnessing is this sort of relentless search for the truth, and also for some kind of how do we as human being behave under duress? What makes us sort of react one way or another? Yeah. Which is, I think, in a sense, I don't know, it's looking for... it's so difficult, I found, with the records. I think one of you was talking about the interview on a radio, the being, you know, the green screen behind where all the information is being filled. I think the job of the poet is to find something that is entirely truth, and then you have to decide whose truth is it and how you portray it.
How do you feel?
Yeah, I think that's an interesting thought. I mean, in contrast to both Carmen and Richard, the witness in my poems is not often really beyond myself. It's not a case of political witness or something that can be looked outward. So So the idea of searching for truth is an interesting one. I think I found that writing about one personal experience often just fell flat for me, or it was easy to become chaotic or just kind of messy. So I was looking for a correlative thing in the natural world, and then asking questions through that idea of the idea of one sort of cancer in nature, and then using that as a way of asking back. Mm. So the idea of, I suppose, I like the idea of leaving a trace in some way, because I think probably that's what lyric poetry is always attempting to say: I was here and I saw that thing, and to hold it in a way outside of time.
So what drew it, your work into that tradition of witness to me is, especially in that long poem, Tongues of Fire, the pressure you put on speaking.
Mm.
You know, there's a lot of it is trying to, like, how do I speak? How do I earn the right to speak about what I've seen?
Yeah.
Which is...
Well, I think that's... Yeah, that's interesting. It's, I mean, in the title of this talk, it was Dictatorship, Terrorism, Ecology, right? And and it's something I think about quite often, is how do you earn the right to speak about ecological witness? Because often we're not in the place where it's happening. And it can feel perhaps a bit ghoulish to, randomly pick a dying, an extinct species or one that's about to go extinct and be like, now I'm going to write a great poem.
It was
about
a poem.
It's a bit, it feels very opportunistic in a way. Or kind of, one thing I was thinking about is the idea that in writing elegies, you're looking back at things that you've lost or things that might be going. But ecological witness often seems to be more prophetic than elegiac, in that you're kind of imagining the loss and putting yourself in this future position where it will all have gone. So I find that action kind of to be odd and a bit fraught morally. It seems a little bit opposite.
Yeah.
Well, I kind of was thinking about, in terms of climate change and witness, in those terms, it's very hard to write poetry about that, because one of the problems with climate change is that it's not so observable to one person in one place, and a lot of the problems we've had come from not thinking about a broader picture. Probably, so it'd be interesting to see a kind of ecological poetry that you try to write from a more kind of collective statistical voice rather than the lyric eye.
It's interesting.
Work on that.
I wonder, do you think you could have written the poem that you did if you weren't there? Do you know, like, does the fact of you being in that place, witnessing it, is your poem...
I just don't like the word witness sometimes. You know, a lot of the times I'm agreeing with it, and, you know, I love what Caroline Fauchet did with that essay in the book, Against Forgetting. But witness is almost as if you are called to the stand, and I've seen this and all of this. Whereas I think what you've done so beautifully with the climate poem and your father is it has become really a personal journey that was so deep into the death. And then so that can be extended really to the dying of species, where, you know, all of the things that actually do affect us. You know, I often think about, you know, my son having asthma and the pollution in the air. This really, really bothers me. Do I have to be there? And I don't think so. I think there's just, like, we all have the rights upon the air, and then suddenly becomes very political, doesn't it, at the same time?
Yeah, you're right.
That's a fascinating question. And with witness, it does imply an eye, a person seeing. It's a kind of visual metaphor which relies on seeing. I wonder... I don't know how long we can overrun by slightly, but if anyone, I thought it might be nice if anyone had any comments or questions, just to have a little room for that. No pressure. Okay, we have a couple.
How
So it's been very difficult because I still haven't finished reading all of the pages. And a lot of them are just sort of documents of, you know, the hammer was applied to the phalanx, to the fingers, and or there's a radiography of the broken ribs. But I think what really helped me and sort of broke through a lot of that was I've taken my father to Romania to the prisons where he was tortured. And I was asking him, how do you feel? Because it wasn't like, but are you hanging on? Are you okay? He was 78, 79 years old when we were there. You know, he was very teary-eyed, and he said, you know, you asked me to take you here, and I'm glad that you want to remember, and you really must remember this, and go ahead and tell people about it, even though it's a lot of self-exposure for the family. How do I feel about the records? It's extremely complicated because I feel that self-exposure, that here you are, you know, this naked family. I mean, literally, we are told not to have curtains in a house. So, you know, you'd have to go and hide and wash yourself in a basin. This is how sort of violent it's been as an invasion. But then when I found the records of the conversations and things that I really don't want to remember, like some of the things were just nasty stuff we said about each other in a house, and some things were very moving, how do I deal and how do I transform those into poetry? I think I went for the things where I felt that my sense of self has taken turns. What does it mean not to have a memory of certain things? Where do I feel validated? Do you know, I wrote Bearing the Typewriter, Childhood Under the Eye of the Secret Police, all with my memories, and the whole family was sort of saying, I can remember the same time and I can remember the same time. And then I had this horrible feeling, is that what if people think that I just kind of made up the buried typewriter? Isn't that a beautiful image, like some dissident buries a typewriter in a garden and, oh, takes it out and types, you know, and then I found the picture in the oil olive container that was my first interrogation. And you know, where is the typewriter? You know? And then I felt like the records also validated, you know, in a sort of very weird way that, okay, look, I'm not making this up. Here you go. Then the pictures of the mailboxes where my parents filled with the pamphlets. So it works in many different ways. I think it has made the whole family very uncomfortable. And then it has made the whole family very proud, because when I put side by side in my book, Releasing the Porcelain Birds, direct transcription from the Romanian translation in my translation, and then the poem that responded to it. And then I thought I would just drag them into the language of poetry, and I would just make the language of poetry just swallow all of that. Because it has to bring it, you know, poetry is there because we want to communicate feelingly with others about our pain. So I thought, okay, poetry just has to take it in. Mm-hmm. So that's it's very difficult to do it. But at the same time, I feel really thrilled because I felt like I got rid of all the pain. It's been a very healing process at the same time.
I think we're going to have to draw it to a close, but that's a wonderful note to end. And okay, all the poets will be around for a bit, signing books and asking any questions. But thank you so much again for those moving, wonderful poems of witness and translation. And, yeah, in their own way, kind of carrying forth experiences to everyone else. Carmen, Sean, Richard, thank you.